What is happening, gang? We have got a big one for you today on the Inside Football Podcast with Bill Polian. In today's episode, building on what we did last week, where we built the roster to 90, in this week's show, we're going to go through the cut down to 53. And this is a really interesting episode because we truly got to pick Bill's brain in terms of how you view that roster you want to take with you into the season, how that works from building your practice squad, how you protect players, how you protect personnel that you don't want being picked on other teams, what you're looking for at camp. And I think the most interesting thing is the evaluation process. We learned a lot about how Bill approached when you evaluate players, how that evaluation worked, how that information was organized within the club. I mean, this is truly a unique window into Bill's brain to learn about what his roster construction philosophy was, how it was implemented, and how it was actually put into practice. So sit back, relax, and get ready. This is the Inside Football Podcast with Bill Polian, and this is the cut to 53. All right. Well, hey, guys, we are excited about this one today. Last week got a lot of really good response in terms of building out that roster to 90. And in this week's episode, we're going to kind of pare it down to 53. And so to that end, Rick, why don't you kick us into the pod today?
So that process of winnowing back down from the 90 to the 53 begins with the first two phases. Of voluntary off-season activity followed by OTAs. Bill, tell us what goes on in each of those three phases and what you're looking for.
Well, in the off-season program, what you're trying to do is build strength and conditioning that will take you through the training camp and the regular season. You're trying to build a base. And for new players who are new to the team, the strength and conditioning coaches get with them, put them through a series of tests to determine where they're strong and where they need work, and they develop individual strength and conditioning programs for each player. The returning players go through a minimal test just to see where they're at, but they've got all of the data on those guys. So they adjust as necessary. And so we always tried to get 6 weeks in because the physiologists tell you that that's the best thing to do. Sometimes you can't because you bump up against the calendar. And of course, when we were in the playoffs, which we were out of the 10 years in a row, and I think 11 out of the 13 we were there, you put yourself in a situation where you try to bring those guys in as late as possible. And we often brought the veterans in much later than the new players. So the new players got more attention and get them inculcated into our culture. That's the first phase of it. The second phase of it is on the field. I don't know a general manager who doesn't cringe when they go out on the field because there's nobody to play. You're not getting ready to play anybody. You're installing the offensive, defensive, and special team systems that you're going to reinstall in training camp. And so it's really a dress rehearsal without pads, but you get injuries. And there was nothing more frustrating for me, and I know with virtually every general manager I spoke about, we'd all call and commiserate with one another during OTAs about how terrible it was to lose players in OTAs. But you have injuries because the young guys are trying to make an impression. The coaches want them to go up tempo. It takes a very, very strong and very secure head coach to dial things down. New coaches come in. They want to show what they can do. It's just your heart's in your mouth every single day you go out there, hoping that you don't get a starter or a key player hurt. Fortunately, we came through most of the OTAs because of Tony Dungy's security and level-headedness. And people like the late, great Howard Mudd, who would often say when things began to ramp up a little too much, hey, we're not playing the Colts this week. We'd make sure that we got through it without any significant injuries. But every once in a while, somebody goes down and you know, your heart's in your throat. I remember one, this was early in Tony's tenure. Some young DB climbed all over Marvin Harrison on a downfield route. And a young DB coach was applauding the effort, and I just couldn't help myself. I just started yelling, "Stay off the receivers!" You know, the guy's one of the best receivers in football, and you know, you're trying to knock him down in a meaningless. It's not a meaningless practice, but there's nothing at stake in the practice. So, it's a rough time. And as I say, all you're really doing is installing what you're going to reinstall anyway at the start of training camp. I'm anxious to see, this is an editorial comment, but I'm anxious to see what becomes of OTAs after this season, because we didn't have any. And the football on opening day was just as good as it was with them.
I was just going to ask you, even back then, you were so conscious of that. I remember us talking about it so many times. Did you ever think the trade-off just isn't worth it? I mean, we're going to reinstall this stuff later. The injury risk is too great, especially since, you know, we went pretty deep into the year with being in the playoffs. Did you ever think, you know, screw OTAs?
Well, yes, often, but, I think we're reaching, at least I am, I'm reaching an equilibrium here where I think hopefully we'll go in the future. If you talk to baseball people, they'll tell you that the position players can get ready in 3 weeks. The reason that you have 6 or 7 weeks of spring training is to get the pitchers ready. And I think this is, we've proven in this offseason, which there wasn't one, that you can get the big people ready. You can get the big people ready. And by and large, the defensive backs ready in about 3 weeks, 4 weeks. You need 2 preseason games at a minimum for conditioning purposes. The injuries that have happened aside, we don't have any. We need long-term statistics on that, but you need 2 preseason games, and you need at least 3 weeks in front of that to get ready. But the reason for OTAs is for the quarterbacks and the receivers, the passing game, and to some degree the defensive backfield. So maybe if you turned it into 7-on-7 for 6 practices or 8 practices rather than 12, you might hit a reasonably good equilibrium. The quarterbacks and receivers do need the extra work. That's the benefit of OTAs.
In terms of team building, though, just in terms of like building camaraderie and those kinds of things, are OTAs like a good tool for that? Or are they more of just kind of, hey, we're here, we're getting our work in, let's get through this?
Well, anytime the team's together, it's helpful. But if you're away at training camp, that's really where you build the camaraderie, where you're with each other 24 hours a day. But certainly anytime you're in the building, it's helpful. And I'm not one who does not want the players in the building. I think the classroom work and absolutely the strength and conditioning work is critical. We did essentially 3 weeks of strength and conditioning work and this off season for, you know, for good and sufficient reason, but it's not enough.
Sort of an early, not necessarily audible, but just something that just kind of popped into my mind. I mean, you see so many guys not going to OTAs and kind of doing their strength and conditioning at home or at these other facilities. Is it your sense that the guys probably get their best work kind of at OTAs, at the facility, from a strength and conditioning process? Or do you think there's some guys who are better suited kind of working at their own kind of programs that they develop for themselves, either back at home or at some of these other facilities?
No, I anytime they're away from the facility where they work, I think they're losing something, and sometimes you're losing a lot depending on who the trainer is you're working with. He might be working at cross purposes to what the strength and conditioning coach at the team wants. You saw that surface a little bit in New England with TB12 a year ago. No, I think they need to be in the building, and they need to be working on strength and conditioning, and they need to be working on individual skills, which you can do without a team-oriented team on the field approach. Definitely the receivers and quarterbacks need the work. So there's an equilibrium you can reach here. I think coaches absolutely, they would give up OTAs. They'd give up family members before they'd give up OTAs, some of them. So, it's going to be a hard go, but.
but not Bob Sanders. We're not giving him up.
No, no. I think there's an equilibrium there somewhere. But the bottom line is that during OTAs, we had a rule, no evaluations. This is teaching, learning, rehearsing, no evaluations.
What about at mini camps? At mini camps, are you doing more evaluating?
No. Our hard and fast rule, and it's interesting, Coach Levy had the very same rule. And Tony and Coach Levy had only a passing acquaintanceship with one another, and the only commonality was Bill Walsh. And that was... Tony was only with Bill Walsh for a year, and Bill Walsh was only with Marv for a year. So it was peripheral at best. But they both saw the evaluation process exactly the same. No formal evaluation until after the first preseason game. And not to say the coaches didn't talk and the scouts didn't talk and everybody has an opinion, but not formally and not within the context of picking the squad until after the first preseason game.
Right. So that's a perfect segue, because that takes us to the next step, which is training camp. Now, your MO was to speak to the team three times a year, and the opening night of training camp was one of them. I think what you would say to them on that occasion is a great lens through which we could view this winnowing process. So can you share the Bill Polian first night of training camp speech with us?
Yeah, well, there were two parts to it. The first would speak to something that had happened the previous year that that I thought needed to be a point of emphasis, and I would clear that with Tony in advance. So one year I spoke about critical efficiency. There are, five, six, seven plays in a game where you have to be efficient. You have to be critical. Those are critical times, and you have to be efficient in order to win the game. So that's one part of it. The second part of it was universal. That occurred every year. And that was to say to the rookies and to remind the veterans, to remind the rookies that from this day forward, it doesn't matter where you were drafted, whether you were the first guy in the draft or the last person signed in collegiate free agency, everybody was equal, and the best 53 make the team. There are no sacred cows. Granted, there are players with big contracts, and obviously we're not about to trade guys that are pro bowlers. We're not stupid. But the bottom line is everybody has an equal chance to make this team. So just because a guy's drafted in the first round doesn't mean he's a lock to make the team. Just because you signed as a street free agent or the last guy signed on the last day of the draft doesn't mean that you won't get a chance. Everybody's going to have the same chance to perform, and we're going to pick the best 53, and we have a system to do that. And if you have any questions about that, ask Gary Brackett. He'll be glad to explain to you how he came in and how he made the team and became defensive captain.
Can you talk about that a little, the Gary Brackett example?
Well, Gary was literally the last guy signed on Sunday afternoon of the draft. And I think we gave him $2,000 or something like that. He came in. He impressed us mightily in training camp and in the preseason. And then he had to leave to donate bone marrow to his brother, who was suffering from leukemia. And that, as you might imagine, is a terribly debilitating process. And so, you know, we had a decision to make at that point. Do we waive him? And because he wasn't, chances are he wasn't coming back that year. And Tony said, oh, no. He impressed us more than enough to make this team. Let's put him on IR and we'll bring him in the offseason and bring him back, let him condition, get through the process. I don't know whether we actually carried him on IR or put him on the practice squad. I can't remember right now but he wasn't on the active roster. And yeah, it could have been PUP. We brought him back, let him get his strength back. He didn't make much of a contribution his rookie year, but the second year he came back and became pretty soon became the starter at middle linebacker and stayed there for the rest of his career.
Now, I would also imagine that, especially with Tony, and though you don't say it, I'm sure that this self-sacrificial aspect of what he was doing had to show you about his character and let you know that not only was a guy who was surprising athletically, but this is a guy you wanted on the team from a character standpoint.
Yeah, absolutely. No question about that.
So circling back to something you had mentioned earlier, kind of related to saving some of those evaluations until after the first preseason game, in terms of early on in camp, how hard is it for you as just a talent evaluator to kind of, A, do that just in sort of from a logic standpoint, and then two, what is kind of the logic behind keeping that evaluation until after the first preseason game? Like, is it so you can install it, see, give everybody a fair shot, and then now that you played a little bit, you can start to evaluate everybody?
Yeah, all of the above, plus the process of evaluation. We had a process where everybody evaluated practice, coaches, players, scouts, every day. Then we'd go back and watch the film at night and evaluate that. So every day we had a file on virtually every player. So there was evaluation going on. It was not going on in a formal way. Stacking the depth chart, if you will. At some point in time, the league put in some silly rule that you had to put out a depth chart the second week of camp or something like that. And it just jogged my memory. I would remind everybody during my talk, the depth chart that comes out means nothing. The league requires us to do it. We just tell the PR office to throw names against the wall and, you know, we know Peyton Manning's the quarterback. Marvin Harrison's the wide receiver.
He's probably not going to be QB2.
Yeah. We're not going to worry about the rest of it. And it doesn't mean anything. So the process went on. And then after the first preseason game, when you get to see them live in action against another opponent in a game setting, now you get oftentimes a completely different view of the player. Players who have shown in practice to get you all excited that you think may have a future go in a game and fall on their face. And guys that you thought were not progressing very quickly go in the game and all of a sudden, particularly on special teams, they light people up and prove that they have a future. So that's why we waited. And then we had a very structured process about how that evaluation went on.
Which, if you're more interested in that, you didn't catch last week's episode, we talked about that. But, you know, it always struck me, and I don't think we've ever discussed this, that there was another value in waiting until the first game, not only the difference between outside of the game issue and playing in a game, but that by letting each person keep his own counsel, you don't get any cross contamination. You know, you go into that with everybody's own pure take, so that some rookie coach when they once they hear Bill Polian opine, to me, that very well could influence, you know, they don't want to speak up, they don't want to say it. But, you know, by letting everybody just not talk, then and you always let everybody else speak before you did, you got, you know, their own honest-to-goodness opinion about each guy without it being affected for fear of what somebody else higher in the ranks was going to say.
Yeah, you're right about that. If there's a funny story that surrounds that, a little bit different circumstance, but nonetheless the same issue. When Tom Telesco became director of player personnel, I happened to wander by his office just before the December meetings were getting underway when the scouts first set the college board. And I said, "What time are your meetings, Tom?" And he said, "Oh, we're going to start at 8:30. And I said, "Oh, okay, I'll pop in." And what are you starting with, quarterbacks? "Yeah, okay." So I went back to my office, and he came in about 10 minutes later, a little bit sheepishly. And he's a soft-spoken guy anyways. But he said, "Bill, I don't quite know how to say this, but I'd rather you weren't in the meetings." And I said, "What? Why?" And he said, "Because the scouts know the guys that you've looked at. If you ask a question, it could be construed as you know, putting your thumb on the scale. Not that you would do that, but it's how they think. So it's better if we do this without anybody else from management in the room." I said, "That's okay. I get it. I'm fine."
Sometimes the inference is, more important than the implication. So, speaking of that, you mentioned in passing something I always found very interesting. In everything that happens in training camp, you get two looks. You know, reminded me of the old, is it Memorex or is it live, right? Because you get out there on the field, you're there every day. You can stand in different places, see different things, and then you get to watch it again on film where you can watch the detail and see what. Tell us what each one of those things allows you to do better than the other, and what are the weaknesses? Why the two ways, and you know, what you can glean better, and then what you can't, and therefore the other makes up for it?
Well, the two are complementary. When you're on the field, unless you happen to be way up high in one of the video lifts or a press box, if there's a high enough venue, you get a narrow aperture. You know, there's a narrow view of things. Your eyes only, and your peripheral vision only extends so far. So you can stand behind a drill. And if it's a one-on-one drill, you get every single bit of it, every nuance. And you can hear, listen to the coaching point. If it's a team drill, you know what the play is. You can concentrate on the point of attack, or you can concentrate on a player that you want to evaluate, and you get to hear the coaching points. That's very valuable because you know what they're asking of the player and whether he's doing it or not. When you look at the tape, now you get almost a 360-degree view of it, certainly 180 degrees. And so you're seeing everybody, and you can slow it down in real time on the field. You have to be pretty quick in terms of getting an opinion and watching and seeing what happened. Just like an official has to have quick eyes. That's the term they use in officiating. With the tape, you don't have to. You can slow it down. You can rewind it. You can do all 22 players on a given play if you wish. So it's just a much broader and wider and deeper look than you get from the field. But the field is still important because you know the play, you hear the coaching, you see how the player reacts. You can see all the nuance of whether one arm is stronger than the other that you don't necessarily get on tape, for example, with an offensive lineman. You can't really see that on tape. You can see it up close and personal.
Hey, there's a couple other things I think you and I have talked about over the years about being out on the field. One was, and it's just a slight variation on what you said before. You know, the guy does something, and you actually hear the full correction from the coach. The guy takes his next rep, and you can really see, is he coachable in the sense that he picks it up right away, or is he the kind of guy who has to be told three or four times before he gets it? And the other thing was the non-football stuff. Who's a leader on the field? Who's the guy who gets everybody excited, who rallies everybody, and all that kind of thing? So there's we talked about the human dynamics of what you get when you're out there on the field, right?
Yeah, the leadership part of it is more nuanced. Yelling is not necessarily a signature of leadership, but in terms of understanding how quickly they pick things up, yes. I mean, you can tell that both mentally and kinesthetically, and it's helpful. I mean, just to hear the coaching. Training camp is two practices a day, essentially for 3 weeks, so you're getting an accumulation of data on each and every player, both live and on tape, which gives you, at the end of those 3 weeks, entering the first preseason game, a broad overview of who the player is and what he is. And then now you're deciding after the first preseason game, and even after that, whether he can take it to the game field when, as they say, the lights go on.
Bill, one question that I think we haven't sort of thought about from this angle. I mean, obviously, there's the implications related to player injuries and sort of player safety related to the reduced padded practices in training camp and those kinds of things. From an evaluator's perspective, do you think some of these changes to the CBA have made it maybe harder to evaluate players through camp kind of headed into that first preseason game? Or is there no real difference?
I don't think there's any real difference evaluatively. I would like to have four preseason games for that purpose, but I'm as obstinate as the coaches that I sometimes criticize about OTAs. You know, the more looks you get in the preseason, the better you can evaluate. So, I just think we certainly could use them. I hope we settle at three. People have asked my opinion over the years, and I've said we can live with three, and still get good evaluations and good preparation, and that's what you get out of the preseason. I've often said, joking or half jokingly, that the only people who dislike preseason are players for obvious reasons, veteran players particularly for obvious reasons, and the media. Because instead of games being at the beach on Saturday night and having an off day on Sunday, they're having to cover games. And if you've ever been in a press box in a preseason game, particularly on the East Coast, where the summer is fleeting and the best of it is being frittered away in press boxes in, quote, meaningless games, close quote, there are a lot of grouchy media people there. They'd much rather be on the golf course or at the beach, as opposed to the media people in spring training in baseball. When it's 20 degrees and sleeting in New York, they wax poetic about, or Pittsburgh, they wax poetic about the glory of the green grass and the sparkling blue sky in Florida or Arizona. So
you can't discredit fans either. There's nothing worse than paying full lift ticket to sit in FedEx Field on a Thursday night when literally no one's playing and you're going home sick.
That's absolutely true. That's absolutely true.
Yeah, and especially once, the price of tickets skyrocketed. You know, it's one thing when you're paying $20 in the old days, but, when it was hundreds and hundreds of dollars, I can't think of, I mean, other than absolute fanatics, everybody was pissed off that they had to pay that money. You know, you didn't have the option. No, I don't want the preseason. Sorry. If you want season tickets, you got to pay for the preseason games. Nobody liked it.
Hey, in COVID, I would kill to be in the stadium right now, but I still hate preseason games.
Yeah.
Well, speaking of preseason games, so kind of headed into those first that first preseason game, are there any things that you're, I mean, obviously you're not formally doing your analysis, but are there any things that you're really concentrating on kind of in evaluating the roster headed into that first preseason game in terms of how guys are preparing themselves for that?
Well, I mean, you don't, other than somebody who's not doing the job on the practice field, which is rather rare, you're not worried about how they're preparing. You're worrying about how they perform on game night. The bottom line is that Tony and I would get together with the coordinators, or Tony would get together with the coordinators and say, you know, who of the young guys do we want to get some work for in this game? You know, what kind of pecking order do we want to have? And they'd put it together roughly. And so the first preseason game, the starters would play a series, and then they're out. And then the second group comes in, and that consists of veteran backups and some young players that you want to take a good hard look at, usually the top draft choices, top three or four draft choices, maybe somebody else who's shown themselves to be exceptional during the ramp-up period, during the camp period. And then they get the rest of the first half, and then everybody else on the squad gets to play in the second half. And then at the end of that game, we go through our evaluation.
Bill, before you do it, let me ask a specific thing about the evaluation. Because this is the first time sort of the wise men get together. And would you take it through that, you know, that there's two separate meetings and who's in the meetings? And just, I think this is a great chance for now you to take our listeners inside the room, if you would. Not just what happens, but give them the feel for it. You know, how you go around, how opinions are exchanged, and so on. Because this is something nobody ever sees.
Well, we had a very specific process that we developed, that we followed every single year, and the first part of it was that the coaches would look at the film individually and then as platoons. And they would grade the players. The pro scouting staff would do the same. And the college scouting staff, who usually is scheduled to leave prior to the first preseason game because the college calendar has changed so much, would have filed reports based on their camp evaluations. And each scout took an individual position and evaluated that position. We didn't use the scouting, college scouts evaluations to cut the squad, but we used it as a means of determining how good a job we were doing in the draft based on the evaluations they had in camp and then how the player actually did with us later on. That would be a kind of a self-scout for our college scouting staff. So those would get filed and put into the player's permanent record, but it didn't factor into the evaluation, make the team process. So after the pro people and myself went through the film and made our evaluations and the coaches made their evaluations, then Tony would get together with the coaches and I would sit in on that meeting and they would evaluate every player. After the first preseason game, most of the time, 80%, 85% of the time in that meeting is spent talking about new players. You know, the old guys, you know what they're capable of doing. Unless somebody has an injury that's bothering him or you know, has some marked fall off in his play, there's not a lot of time spent on you know, the starters. So, for example, Clyde Christensen, our quarterback coach, would say, you know, Peyton wasn't as sharp as he normally was, but I don't know that he had his head in the book as much as he does. He's fine in practice. Everything's good. It was a decent outing. No problem. And then he spent a lot of time talking about Jim Sorgi. So that's how that first meeting went. And at the end of that first meeting, Tony would have the coaches line them up by position. We had a big board, big whiteboard with magnetic tags on it, which had the player's name and his information, height, weight, speed, three cone drill, and personality grade, if you will, psychological grade, and then his contract status. And so we would line those guys up by position. And so obviously Peyton Manning would be first, but, you know, did Jim Sorge show enough to be second? Or is he third behind Mark Rippon? That discussion would actually take place with the coaches, and I was in the room taking notes. And I took copious notes. I rarely said a word. I just sat there and listened. Tony would ask questions from time to time. But most of the time, he would just let the coaches give their evaluations. He would take notes as well. And then they would have some discussions about how they wanted to line them up. So if, for example, Rip was not there the same time Sorge was, I don't think, but I'm just using it as an example. Tony would say to Clyde and to Tom Moore, our offensive coordinator, Jim Caldwell actually was the quarterback coach at the time. He would say to Jim, do you want to give Rippon more work next week, or would you rather see more of Sorge? And then Jim would make that decision and tell us. Because Sorge was showing us some stuff. You know, he was promising. So that's the way it would go at every position. And another example, after the first preseason game, Antoine Bethea cemented his position as a starter. So the question was asked of the defensive backfield coach and Leslie Frazier, who was essentially the coordinator, and saying, hey, do we want Bethea in there right away, or do we want to play him with the second group? And if I remember correctly, Tony may have been the one that said, let's get him in there and get his feet wet. He's going to make the team. There's no question about that. Let's see how he does with the first group. So in the second preseason game, he's in there with the first group. Those are the decisions that are made after the first preseason game. And then there's a part of that meeting where you discuss special teams viability. So the special teams coach now takes center stage and says, I need to see the following guys on special teams. So we need to get them on every special team, every core four special team, the core four being kickoff return, punt return. So we need to see David Thornton on every core four. We need to see Gary Brackett on every core four. We need to see Cato June on every core four, et cetera. And so they would have what amounted to a depth chart at the end of that meeting. That's a long meeting. That can go anywhere up to 3 hours. Tony and I, usually the following day, would get together and we'd have our own depth chart. and so Tony would say, you know what? I think we probably need to give Sorge a little more time than Rip. Let's find out about Sorge. He's interesting. What do you think? I said, I agree. So
this is the double secret probation depth chart.
Right. Well, no, not really, but it was just
the one that matters.
It was a cross check.
I think it's more. That's the depth chart that actually means something.
Yeah, exactly.
And all it was doing was apportioning playing time. And so, and we didn't make, there weren't many differences between what the coaches had and what we had. It was usually, you know, Tony and I were of exactly the same mind. You know, this guy, Sorge, he's really showing us a lot. Bethea's really showing us a lot. Let's get their feet wet. Tony was always anxious to have young players get an opportunity to play. And so was I, because for every young player you have on the team, it gives you more salary cap room, very honestly, although that didn't enter the equation. I think we said this in the last show, but I need to reiterate this. We would make every salary cap move in the off season before we ever began OTAs. And so the coaches knew, because I would tell them every year, you cut the squad for the best 53 football players. There are no salary cap issues here. None whatsoever. So don't worry about salary cap.
Yep.
That's been taken care of.
Which is one of the, you know, and maybe it's just for storylines or whatever. But again, with the, you know, the many differences between reality and what's reflected in the media, you know, you always hear as training camp's going through, well, they've got to keep this guy. Now, maybe other teams didn't do it that way, but certainly with the Colts, it, you know, as you said, it became a non-issue, even though the press following the Colts would speculate about, can you afford to keep this guy versus that guy, when it really is not even an issue at that point.
No, it's not. I mean, that was just our process. I don't know how other people did it, but that was just our process, and we wanted to be true to what we told the players, which was everybody's going to get a fair evaluation here. It doesn't matter how much money you make or don't make.
Would you try to preserve some portion of the cap for things that might happen throughout camp if, you know, there's a surprise cut on another team?
Oh, yeah, absolutely.
What kind of percentage, just for our sort of fake GM hat on, so that if this ever happens one day, like, do you try to allocate like 3 or 4%, 5%? Is it a percentage thing? How do you actually handle that?
We would go back and calculate a standard, if you will, injured reserve budget. That's basically about, you know, 1 6-week injury for every game you play. So somewhere between 16 and 18 injured reserve salaries at a median salary. And then what it costs in signing bonus dollars to sign the rookies. Because we were always on a cash budget. We always had a cash cap as well as the salary cap. And the cash cap was, as you might imagine, the most important one. That's the one we lived with.
Right.
And so that was anywhere, and this is back in 10 and 11, 9, 10 and 11. That's anywhere between $6 and $8 million that you just take off the top before you ever start the process of signing players. That's left in the bank, so to speak. Now, somehow or other, we didn't use all of it every year, and somehow or other, it would disappear from the budget the following year.
If you don't spend it, you don't get to keep it.
Exactly.
Yeah.
Federal government edict.
You got to spend your money on FTEs or you lose it.
Yeah, every year I would argue that we should get that carried over just like cap room, but that argument didn't prevail. In any event, that's what we did. We set aside, let's call it $8 million. I don't know what the number would be today on $189 million cap. Well, this year it'll be 175. So it's probably somewhere around 5%.
Okay. So then how does the preseason game 2 evaluation differ at all from 1? Or is it pretty much kind of the same process?
Same process, except now you're starting to get a feel for who really has a chance to make the team. So let's just say that you went through 4 running backs and there are 3, Dominic Rhodes, Edgerrin James, James Mungerow, who are, you know, the backfield coach says, you know, these are the 3 that I think are going to make it. I don't know about the other 2. And so the question would be then, who of the other 2 do you play to try and get a feel for it, whether you want to keep 4 or 3 or go on the waiver wire to pick up a 4th? Who's going to be the goal line and short yardage back? specific position discussions that affect the 53 take place in that meeting after the second preseason game, because the third preseason game in our terminology was the dress rehearsal. The starters were going to play a half and a series in the second half so they could get used to playing the half and going inside and you know, getting freshened up and adjustments being made, and then go out and play another series in the second half. So you're going to limit the time that the backup people played. So, for example, Dominic Rhodes and Edgerrin James would probably get a quarter each in the third preseason game. And then James Mungrow and somebody else would get the rest of the game, but the Mungrow was going to get a lot of the load because we wanted to get him ready to play because he's going to be on the team. And then the special teams function in that meeting after the second game, second preseason game, is a long one, because now the special teams coach is saying, well, I don't know if I've got a role for Mungrow. Where can we use him? So now you start to get into really nuanced discussions. I'd rather have Jones. Okay, that means we'd have to carry four running backs. So that's a big note that I'm making on my depth chart. How many running backs do we carry? Three or four? Because the fourth guy, the special teams coach, wants. In our system with Tony and Jim Caldwell was a little less rigid than Marv's. Marv's position always was the last player at every position will be the best special teams player. And that's just the way it was going to be. So Bobby Ross, who's a name that football fans will remember, was our special teams coach in Kansas City my first year there with Marv. And Bobby had the say, you know, at every position with the last guy. And that included the long snapper, who really had no position. We were one of the first to carry a long in Kansas City. We were the first to carry a long snapper who had no position. And I remember a discussion that was really funny. Marv said, "Well, you know, let him work with the linebackers." And Rod West, who was the coordinator, defensive coordinator, and linebacker coach, said, "I don't want him." Marv said, "Well, just let him work there. He can do scout team work." And Rod said, "I don't want him. I don't want him in my room." So it was really funny. So that special teams discussion affected how many players you carried at a specific position. And my pet peeve, I never voiced this except with the coordinators and Tony, was that I was always trying to search for a short yardage and goal line back, a big blaster who could convert short yardage and goal line. Now, you have probably six of those a game, but he has no role on special teams, largely, unless he's the personal protector. And sometimes he's not even big enough to do that. So, you know, how do you find a room for that guy on the squad? And that would be a pretty lengthy discussion. And sometimes you had the guy and sometimes you didn't. We were best on short yardage and goal line when we took Dan Klecko, a defensive tackle, and made him the fullback and put him in front of Edgerrin. We were really good. That was the year we won the Super Bowl. And so it proved that we needed him, but there had to be another way to find him, which you know, I never focused on. But that's what those discussions would be about. And so the third preseason game would play out. And now in the fourth preseason game, we knew who was going to start. And many of those guys didn't even dress. We took them. If we always played Cincinnati, so it was a short bus trip, no matter at which place it was played. It was 2 hours, and the Bengals were great about that. You know, great hosts, and we try to reciprocate. And in our case, we wouldn't even dress the starters, and everybody else would get to play. So all the backups would play, the key backups would play probably a quarter, and then all the young players would get to play the rest of the game. Now, the Bengals' approach was different. They would play their starters a half. So the score at the end of the half would be Bengals 27, Colts 3, if we were lucky. But it didn't matter, because we wanted to see how those young guys stood up against the Bengals starters. It was a great experiment. It was a great test for us. And it took a little while for Jim Irsay understood it immediately, but it took a little while for me to explain to the fans and the media why that was happening.
So, Bill, to me, the way you've explained it, there's sort of two tracks that are parallel, but slightly different. Because on one hand, as you're evaluating growth and deeper insight into how somebody is, you've got the rookies. So, and there's certain expectations for them. But then you have guys on the team who are the sort of the special team veterans who aren't even necessarily the you know, first backup and so on and so forth. Talk about what you need to see from a rookie from day one in training camp versus what is it that you need to see to say, okay, this veteran who, you know, who has been a good guy, but he's been on the team 2 years, you know, what do we have to see to actually want to keep him around for the third year? Talk about those two different sets of expectations and what people have to do to fulfill your desire to keep them around.
Well, it's really one competition. We don't have a desire to keep them around. It's a question of who's better. So I'll give you an example. Justin Snow came in as a rookie from Baylor, had not been a long snapper at Baylor, but we knew he could do it because I'd seen him do it in practice. He was a starting defensive end, so they didn't use him as the long snapper, but I knew he could do it. So he came in, and Bradford Banta, I believe, was the returning veteran, and in the end, we kept Justin because he was younger and frankly less expensive, but he was actually a little bit better. The special teams coach at the time wanted to keep Bradford, but we said, no, look, it Snow's outplayed him. And you know, that's the way it is. In another situation, you might have an offensive guard who was a young guy who might have been challenging a veteran like Tony Mandarich, who had injury issues and age issues. But at the end of camp, you know, Howard Mudd said, I don't think this guy's shown enough to have us move Tony along. So we're gonna keep Tony. I'm not sure that actually happened. I'm just using that as an example. Typically, you would have a situation where, and this is why the process is so important, you'd have a situation where a player would come in like Jeff Saturday, make the team based on what he did in the 4 preseason games, spend a year as a backup. Howard would find out which position was best for him. He'd stick him in there the following year, move the veteran on, and that's the way it would go. And that's the way it's supposed to go. And we did the very same thing in Buffalo. That's why the process is so important. It has to be thoughtful. It has to be fact-based. It has to be, full-throated evaluation. It can't be knee-jerk. It can't be, I like this guy. It's got to be a thorough process. And the thorough process leads to orderly transition on your squad.
Got it. I guess the only thing I was saying was, since you're paying veterans more, and they're getting older, was there not comparing them to the rookie or who's going to make the squad, but was there a growth that you wanted to see to keep a guy around for a second or a third year within his, that if he wasn't on an upward tick, that he was getting closer to being a backup or a backup getting closer to being a starter, that would make it more likely to be replaced by somebody else because he was not moving in the positive direction. He was just flatlining.
Well, that rarely happened in camp, and that's a decision you make at the end of the regular season. That's where that January meeting comes in. If you had a guy 2 years and he was flatlining and not making progress, then you probably let him go at that point.
Okay, so you know by then. Okay, so it wasn't.
Yeah, and don't forget, salary doesn't mean anything at this point. We've covered that base.
No, I agree. I just meant now he's going to be around for another year or two to have to figure into it. But I wasn't thinking you'd keep them one way or the other. But okay, so that goes back to aside.
If what you're asking is what's the timeline for evaluation of long-term growth, it's 3 years. You know at the end of 3 years whether a guy's going to have a long-term future or not.
There you go. So thank you, Bill Polian, because you asked my question and gave the answer.
It's always nice. That happens a lot behind the scenes as well, guys. Yeah, so that's a good thing. Hey, one quick thing before we jump into the final meeting. How close through the preseason game process are you monitoring what's happening with other teams in terms of seeing guys that might be potential cuts that you might want to add? How closely, I know we touched on this a little bit in the scouting, but I mean, at this phase, how aware are you of everything that's going on around the league with potentially players that could become available who might be useful?
Very, 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 very. The pro scouting staff has scouting assignments that they're doing. They're out every week at 3 and 4 games a week, looking at the tape when they come back, compiling a list of players to claim. It's called the claim list. Logically, very logically.
Yeah, seems to make sense. That's fair.
It would be on a closed board in the pro scouting office. And after we finished the day after we finished our own Colts squad evaluation, we would have a formal meeting with the pro scouting staff to cover the claim list. Who did we think would come out? That's a little bit of divining rod there, trying to figure out who the other people are going to cut. But each scout is assigned so many teams in the NFL, so they're expert on that. They have good opinions on it. And then who of that group would we want to claim? And in the meeting after the third preseason game, in the Tony Bill meeting, we would say to one another, maybe even bring the coordinators in, and we would say to one another, who do we think, what positions do we think we need to improve? Because it stands to reason that people you're going to get on claims, there's one rare exception, which I'll cover in a second, but you're not going to get people on claims, generally speaking, that are going to be starters. You're adding depth to your team. So the question is, at what positions are we satisfied with our depth? At what positions do we need depth? So we would have that outlined. And Tony would often, and Jim would often attend those formal pro meetings, claim meetings. Those began after the second preseason game. And after the third preseason game, you got to be ready to go. The claim list is virtually final at that point. There were two position groups that stood alone. The first was special teams. Now, we didn't ever have any problems with punters or kickers. Those positions were handled in the off season. As I mentioned, Justin Snow was the long snapper for as long as we were there. But key core people on special teams we would be interested in. So the special teams coach would have the ability to say, I like Terrence Wilkins as a return man. I think he can make our team. I want him on the team. So if he's the fifth receiver, so be it. We're not going to get better than him on the wire. That's the phrase that's used, meaning the waiver wire. Or he would say, I'm not satisfied with our return man, and I think we ought to be looking for one. So he was a standalone. I'm not satisfied with my personal protector. I think we should be looking for somebody there, either internally or externally. So he had his own needs that he would enunciate and we would follow. And then Howard Mudd, the offensive line coach, because of his iconic status, Hall of Fame coach status, was an island unto himself. So he would just say, I got the eight guys I want. Don't worry about it. Whatever you're going to add to the practice squad, that's fine. Or he would say, no, I don't like the eighth guy. I think we need better. So that's how we approached it. Now, there's an interesting, really interesting story that tells you exactly why you need to be prepared. Whoever had Kansas City, I can't remember who the scout was, it might have been Kevin Rogers at the time, said to me and to Tom Telesco and Chris Polian, you got to look at this guy, Ryan Lilje. I don't think he's going to make their team. He's too small for what they want, but he's perfect for us. So we all looked at the tape. This was after the second preseason game. And we said, wow, this guy's pretty special. He can do everything we want. The problem is he's 6'1" and weighs about 290 pounds, which is way too small for a guard. Maybe even for us, but way too small for most people. So I took the tape to Howard. I said, take a look. So Howard came back and said, get this guy. Let's trade for him. So we discussed whether or not we should trade for him. And we said, no, let's don't trade for him. Let's sit tight because we think he's going to come out. So Howard is like a cat on a hot tin roof on cut down day. He wanted Lilje in the worst way. And of course he was right. And we were saying, don't worry about it. We'll get him on a claim. This is, we don't have to give up anything here. So sure than heck, here comes Ryan Lilje on the waiver wire. We couldn't get the claim in fast enough. We got him, and he ended up starting, I think, at left guard for us for 4 or 5 years. And later on, both Carl Peterson and Dick Vermeil, Carl called me and Dick called Howard and said, damn it, did we make a mistake? We thought we could get him through waivers. You dang guys, we're out there. So that leads me to the next step, which is the final piece in the puzzle is determining who you put on waivers in order to get them through to the practice squad. Who of the young players do you put on waivers in order to get them through to the practice squad? And who do you put on waivers hoping they won't be claimed? We didn't do much of the latter at all. We were very conservative.
So before you get to that, could we take a step back? And so this is prior to that decision. Could you talk about the dynamics of that fourth preseason game meeting where, each guy's making a case for what he needs? Because it's a little different. It's not just this guy's good or this guy's good. It's, how many guys and so on. So could you share that with everybody? Because I think it's a really interesting methodology that you use.
Well, you set the numbers. Tony set the numbers, generally speaking. So you'd carry, two quarterbacks, one on the practice squad, four running backs, five wide receivers, sometimes two or three tight ends, depending on how the third tight end fit on special teams, and eight offensive linemen. maybe nine if you had an injury or something like that, but usually eight, and then two would go to the practice squad. On defense, it was always the same, seven to eight defensive linemen, a minimum of six linebackers, a minimum of seven DBs, maybe eight, and you'd balance it off depending on how many defensive linemen or linebackers you'd carry. So it was really the 50 to 53rd guys were the third tight end, the fourth running back, the sixth linebacker, the eighth defensive lineman, and the eighth defensive back. You choose, you know, between, you'd pick three to four of those eight.
So that was pretty standard year in and year out.
Yes.
Yeah, and some of that came down to scheme and so on and so forth. Okay, so, all right. Now that we know how, you know, that got determined, take us through the strategy with, you know, with the cuts and how you would try and make the system work for you.
Well, the rules are as follows. There are two rules that come into play here. The first is that any vested veteran who is on the team on opening day has his contract guaranteed for the full season. So if you have a vested veteran that you think, I'd like to have him as a backup, but I don't want to guarantee him the whole season, then you have to waive him through and bring him back after the first game. So if we have any listeners who are fantasy football people and they see one of their favorite veterans get waived just prior to the cut to 53 and then come back, that's the reason. They just don't want to guarantee him for the whole season. The second part of it is players that go to the practice squad have to clear waivers first. So any player that you want to add to the practice squad, assuming not the rules this year, but assuming the old rules where he had to be first or second or third year player, non-vested veteran, those guys have to go through waivers, and then you can sign them after they clear waivers. So now the question is, here's where your last question comes into play. Is the sixth linebacker you want to keep, excuse me, a rookie who you'd rather have on the practice squad, but you're worried that he'll get claimed? That's a tough decision, and that's a Tony, Bill, Chris, Tom, sometimes Jim Irsay management decision. That's the management group makes that decision with great deference to the head coach. So, you know, because Tony had an affinity for young players and believed that they added value and life and verve and excitement to the squad, he would tend to keep the young kid and take a chance on losing the rookie and then flop the next week if we had to bring the veteran back, put the rookie onto the practice squad. Tony did not like to lose promising practice squad players, if at all possible, to a waiver claim. And the waiver claims, because of the increase in pro scouting and the amount of information that's out there and tape that's out there, you know, are up well above 60 every year. They were lower this year, but they're normally well above 60 around the league. So you're going to lose two, maybe three, four guys on waiver claims if you put them out there. So that was a lose sleep decision, and you have to wait a long time. The waiver wire goes in at noon, and it's not until somewhere around 8 o'clock at night that you find out whether your guys have cleared or whether or not you got someone that you claimed. So that's a long 8 hours, a lot of pacing.
Well, you got to get your steps. I mean, it's a good way to get steps.
Yes,
it's the league helping you with health. I mean, come on.
Well, you've always got those insights, Scott, that, you know, can turn a negative into a positive. So
yeah.
So Bill, I don't want to pass on one other important thing, because we're talking about process here. You know, we're talking about movement of guys, but, you know, I want to talk about actually cutting people and what that means, you know, in terms of guys, at the very least, you've been around since you drafted them or signed them as free agents. You've been through the OTAs, you've been through mini camps, you've been through training camps. These guys are all busting their asses to make it. You have veterans who, you know, as you say, going into a certain year, just may not making the kind of progress. But no matter who it is, it's not an easy thing telling a guy he's cut from the football team. Because, you know, some of them, you know very well that this is the end of their dream in life. You know, others, you think they have a chance to continue, but not right as of that minute. So talk to us about the procedure for informing guys they've been cut, the various levels they fall into regarding your degree of ongoing interest in them, and the advice you give each guy based on that future interest, so that you're not misleading somebody, you're giving, you know, you're encouraging when you should, but it's very personal. You take it very seriously. It's not something you do in a cold-hearted way. Take us through that day, you know, when the guys are getting a knock on the door, and bring your playbook.
Well, that doesn't happen because they're not in camp any longer. But they're in hotels or you know, most of them. We keep the team in one hotel during the preseason. So Tony would tell everybody on the night before the final preseason game, listen, we'll be making the cuts on Friday. The cuts don't have to be in until Saturday, but we'll do it on Friday. So have your phone handy. Be around. Whether you made the team or you haven't made the team, we need to call you and get your status squared away. So be alert to a call. And then every year I would remind all the staff, the training staff, the equipment staff, the medical staff, and certainly our own personnel staff, the likelihood is we're ending somebody's dream today. And so take that into consideration. You know, be professional, but also be humane about this. And it's hard to end somebody's dream. I mean, it just is. These kids are the best from grade school all the way through college. And now, all of a sudden, for the first time in their lives, someone is saying to them, you're not good enough. So, for whatever reason. So we try to take that approach from a humanistic standpoint, if you will. So then someone from the personnel staff would make the calls. We would do it in a pecking order. The guys who we were not going to keep on the practice squad would get the first calls, and they would be told, come to the office. They would see Tony. They were given a form when they reported to the office that had to be filled out by the equipment man, by the trainer, by the doctor. And they had to sign certain forms for the league, that said that they, you know, were given all their rights, et cetera, in release. And then, they would get to see me at the end of that process. And with those guys, I would try to say as charitably as possible, listen, you know, you're not going to make our team, and we probably don't have room for you at the moment on the practice squad, but there's always the possibility that you will be claimed, and I hope you are. And if you want to continue chasing the dream, then by all means do so. I would know basically what their degree status was. And so if a guy had his degree, you know, my response would, or my advice would be, listen, you've gotten your degree. If you want to go pursue professional football in Canada or, you know, get on the tryout circuit in the NFL, by all means, do so. You know, make sure that you give yourself every chance. If they didn't have their degree, you know, I'd say my advice would be go back and finish your degree. The likelihood of a long career in professional football probably is not in the cards for you, so it's really important that you finish. And Tony would give the same advice. So then those fellows would leave, and then the next group to come in would go through the exact same process, except the discussion with Tony and I would be different. Tony would say to them, we want to keep you on the practice squad, and we think you have a future with us. We just don't have room for you on the 53. And Bill will explain to you what the process is. So then they would go through the whole outboarding process, if you will, and then come to me. And then I would say to them, look, we want to keep you on the practice squad, but we have to put you on waivers in order to do that. So you're going to go to Chris or Tom and sign a futures contract with us, which will be activated if you clear waivers. Now, I'm probably telling a tale out of school, but the statute of limitations has probably run on that.
I was about to warn my client to stop speaking at this point, but go ahead.
I haven't heard it.
So they would, in a lot of cases, want to talk to their agents, and then we would discuss things with their agents. And the agents are really good. They understand exactly what the process is, and everybody kind of does it the same way. So, and you know, I would always say to them, look, selfishly, I hope you're not claimed. For your sake, I hope you are claimed. But if you're not, there's a home for you here. So be prepared to come to work tomorrow. Someplace. And so they would go back, and then we'd be in touch with them when and if they cleared waivers, or if they didn't, we had to call them and say, listen, you haven't cleared. The Bears have claimed you. And people from the Bears will be in touch with you if they have not been already. So that's the way that process worked. And then if it was a veteran that we were cutting, that was a little more difficult, because you get to know those guys. I mean, they're people who, to one degree or another, have bled for you and given you good service. So those would be the last people we'd talk to. And, you know, that can get a little emotional from time to time, especially if it's a guy that, you know, you have a long relationship with. But in their case, most of them know that they still have at least another year left in the NFL, and their benefits stay in place for a year. And, you know, the likelihood is that they're probably going to get a job somewhere along the line. That was the process, and it took most of the day, and then obviously we had to put the wire in the next day, and then wait for the claims to clear. In the meantime, the pro scouts and the pro executives are getting, or the personnel executives are getting calls, you know, night and day from agents trying to place guys that they know have already been cut. And the agents also will reveal to the media who've been cut. So we wanted to make sure, that's why we did it on Friday. We wanted to make sure that everybody knew before somebody in the media speculated about them being cut. That to me would be the worst thing that would happen. And then occasionally I would have an agent would say, would you mind talking to so-and-so's parents, and I, you know, I always would. And you shoot straight, but you try to do it in the most humane way you possibly can. And you know, the relationships with veterans are the ones that are the hardest to end, because, as I say, you become friendly with them. They're your teammate. They're not employees. They're your teammate. And you know, you get to know them, you get to know their families. It's difficult. And then occasionally, you know, you have guys who, and this happens in February and March, not in September, but you have guys who decide, hey, I played 4 or 5 years. It's time for me to move on. And in more than a few cases, I've had guys come in or call me after they've left and said, listen, would you mind writing a recommendation for me to law school or to business school? And obviously I'm honored to do it. And it just, it reinforces that the way that we did things registered with the players, which is really what our goal was in the first place.
Were there many players you maintained relationships with over the years after they were cut?
Oh, yeah, sure. See many of them, obviously, at reunions and things like that, Hall of Fame ceremonies, Ring of Honor ceremonies, where typically they'll bring back the whole team. I had a note from a player for whom I wrote a recommendation to law school who sent me an email and said that he'd passed the bar exam. And so I those things happen.
It's always got to feel good.
Not frequently, but enough to make you think that, you know, what you're doing means something besides just wins and losses.
Right,
which is always the important thing in life. Well, I think on that note, we will push our way into the audible today. And I think I'm going to pull just an audible of an audible today with my question. And it's going to be a two-parter. So this, I feel like, happens. We've talked a little bit about espionage. But, like, how often when in the sort of pre-COVID world and, God willing, in the post-COVID world, when fans could go to training camp, how often do you think teams would send sort of advanced scouts to watch what's happening with the other teams? And also, as a Washington football team fan, I feel like the Eagles have done this to us every year, where we'll inevitably cut someone, they will sign them for week one, and then they just beat our brains in. Thank God it didn't happen this year with Richard Rodgers, but it seems to happen all the time. How often do you feel like those things happen, and then how effective are those brain-picking sessions when you're pulling in somebody who's just recently been cut?
Well, you're asking two different questions, so I'll answer them
two,
in order.
Two-parter.
Yeah, two-parter. The first is that the league rule is, if the club charges admission for a practice or a scrimmage, you can send scouts to it. And everybody does that. You might remember when the Redskins charged admission to their training camp practices.
Oh, I have paid it.
Everybody had people there.
Another very popular move.
I will admit this on the podcast. I've paid it many times.
Don't tell me you were happy to pay it, though.
There was a time, but now not so much.
That's under the heading of scouting, and it's allowed. The other covert espionage is not allowed, frowned upon greatly. And while it's never happened, I think if someone was caught, they would be just short of Nathan Hale in terms of what repercussions there would be. Once upon a time, a guy that I worked for with another club when I was a shave tail, not the Kansas City Chiefs, by the way, ordered me to go do that. And I politely said no and went to the general manager and told the general manager, look, this is what he asked me to do and I'm not going to do it, just so you know. That's really, really frowned upon within the industry. Not to say it doesn't happen, but it's really frowned upon, at least in my experience. Claiming a guy to pick his brain, George Allen was the first person that I heard of doing that, and he did it frequently. Bring the guy in, pick his brain. You got to pay him for the week, and then you let him go the next week. The coaches that I were with, including Marv, who had worked for George Allen, didn't think it was worth very much. If it was a quarterback that you were getting, or if it was a defensive signal caller, maybe a safety or a middle linebacker, you might glean something, but you'd be surprised. Most players don't know the big picture. They know their position and not much more. So, you know, if you pick up a player from, let's say, that the Colts are playing the Redskins next week, or the Washington football team, I should say. To make it easy for me, let's call it the Ravens. The Colts are playing the Ravens next week, and we want to claim a guy from the Ravens offense to know what their code words are. You know the Ravens are changing the code words. They're not going to use the same code words. So, and now you don't have to do it anyway because you can get the code words off the television tape. Because the center or one of the guards is mic'd. And so all you have to do is have your tech people filter out the sound and you get everything. It used to drive us crazy because we used so much verbiage at the line of scrimmage. Jeff Saturday somehow, his mic would break every week. You know, Peyton would be really upset about it. We had to change the verbiage every week, so that part you can get without bringing a player in. So we didn't do a lot of it. I know it's done on occasion. I don't think quite as frequently as it used to because more information is out there electronically.
All right, here's my audible question, but there's a little backstory. In our last show, in a display of incredible modesty, Bill Polian took umbrage with favorably being compared to a billionaire genius. So this time, Bill, no analogies, no metaphors, no similes, nothing. I'm just going to ask it straight up. But it does ask for a comparison. Because I wanted to try to understand how truly subjective versus objective the process we just described. So if you took, and let's just say, five of the GM head coach combinations that you respect most in the league, and all of you started with 90 and we're going down to the 53. How similar, and this is scheme aside, forget scheme, how similar do you think you would be to one another just in your evaluation of those players, their future, and so on and so forth? How closely would those 53s align with one another?
I would say probably 65 to 70% would align. The other 35% reacts to scheme, is directly related to scheme. So, for example, let's use Baltimore as an example. They want corners who can cover man-to-man. They'd like them to be long and have long arms, but they'll take smaller guys. Man-to-man coverage is important. With us, it was not as important. So we would keep different guys, as opposed to what Baltimore might keep.
So that says something about your level of faith in your peers because, if you absent out scheme, you're saying that generally each team, or at least the ones that are the best ones, are good enough that in terms of valuing who the 53 are that are best for their team, they're going to wind up. And if you had their scheme, you would have taken their players and done the same thing. So that even though there's so much that isn't measurable, even though this is human beings we're dealing with, obviously both the people that are doing the job are very good at their jobs. And with everything we have now in terms of evaluation, that's become very sophisticated, and it generally yields the best product.
Oh, without question. And I would disagree with the idea that it's not measurable. The fact that you're giving an educated opinion based on years and years of experience, you don't get to professional football unless you've had or a position of authority in professional football, unless you've had years of experience. That's not off the wall. It's not subjective. You're trying to make it as objective as you can, but you know that's an educated opinion. It's not an uneducated opinion. A machine could not do it any better, because the human being brings intuition and experience to that the machine cannot.
No, yeah, that in fact was my point. Even the things that are not easily reducible to numbers, the experience level and the insight that folks at that level have in the NFL is such that they can make an evaluation without a stopwatch, without a broad jump, without a testing arm strength, where they can get a sense of the whole player, of everything from his willingness to sacrifice, his desire to be a good team, everything rolled up in the ball. They really can make that decision, which should actually also, with what we were talking about with the guys where it's sad that they don't make the team, but that should give them some solace that this was not haphazard, this was not unfair, that this was a very successful professional evaluation, and they just got to the level where their ability, their talent just couldn't carry them past that. So, that should make those guys actually feel better about things. It wasn't just dumb luck that they didn't make it and other guys did.
No,
I'm still going to feel pretty bad. I'm still feeling bad if I don't make the team.
Well, keep this in mind, though.
So
keep this in mind. Don't lose the lessons of the episode that we did last week. The measurables, the height, weight, speed, the test scores, the personality evaluations, the psychological evaluations, all of those factor into the decision of how you get to the 90. All of that's been baked into the cake before you ever set foot on the field. So those do play a role, a very important role. They're barriers to entry. And unless you can pass that examination, you're not going to get on the field. So that makes the evaluation much more scientific. That's why Bill Parcells always says, if you make one exception, you'll end up with a team full of exceptions. You don't want exceptions to the barriers to entry. So all of that's baked into the cake, as I say. And now everybody's equal. Everybody's on equal footing. And now you're trying to judge them as football players.
Right. Right.
Very true. All right. Yeah. What do you got, Rick?
I just wanted to say, let me know. We're flipping positions here. Let me know whether you are going to be the silver linings playbook guy or I am. Right. Who's going to be the positive spin on whatever Bill says? I think we should show by show go by it.
I'm Pat Celentano for life. I got my Deshaun jersey fully ready. Hey, so we're going to end on this today. So, Bill, are you joining the revolution? Are you taking your clubs in today and getting them all cut to the same length like I did a year ago?
No, I am not, because, I'm so bad that I don't think no method could help me at this point in time. I'm on the edge of despair.
I'm telling you, all my friends who thought I was crazy when I followed it and did it and got significantly better, I cannot recommend this enough. On the heels of the U.S. Open yesterday, everybody should do it. It makes life a lot easier.
All right. I'll have to talk to you about it. I'm open to it.
Well, all right, gang. Thank you again so much for an awesome show today. As always, if you have questions or things you want us to hit on in the Audible or any topics you want us to consider, please hit us up on Twitter at IFBillPolian, and we'll be sure to do it. And for all you out there, if you want to read The Golfing Machine, it's a good week to do it.
And if your game doesn't improve, tell Scott.
Blame me. All right, guys.
Stay safe, everyone.
Yep, absolutely. Be well.